welcome back to another episode of Data Protection Gumbo. And of course, you know me, I am your host, Demetrius Malbro. And today we have Giorgio Regni, who is the Chief Technology Officer at Scality on the show. Giorgio, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am doing well and looking forward to talking a little bit about immutability. And as I understand from you, there are different levels or different degrees of immutability. So before we dive into that, give us a brief overview of yourself, your skill set, and how long you've been with Scality.
Yes. So I'm one of the co-founders of Scality. We created a startup, but I think it's 20 years old. No, it's not that old. But we've been in the business securing deployment, people who want to build their own cloud internally. We can also send data back and forth with the public cloud in some hybrid scenarios. It's all about scalability, data durability, and making sure that your application is always online and never has to wait for storage.
Nice. And we know making sure that everything is online and that you don't have to wait, because everything is 24/7 now. And it's all about how fast can you recover. Yeah. And making sure that the availability of that data is always on point. Now, let's talk about immutability. First of all, give us a definition. And I know the listeners know what it means, but what's your definition of immutability?
Yeah. So it used to be that immutability was coming from the medium, you know, so use a CDR that you cannot override, or use some type of device that you cannot physically override. And the SEC, you know, with the 17A-4, right, made okay to do a virtual immutability. So you can do it in software and processes, as opposed to having to do it with the media. But what it means is once data is written, nobody can change it.
Okay. Absolutely. Now, there's a blog post out there. Paul, he wrote a blog post, and I've read through it. And he goes on to talk about immutability, and there's a true immutability, and not all immutability is created equal. Yeah, you also think you feel the same way, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. So I don't know if I would say true immutability, but I would agree that they're not equal on the system. There's so many variables. What happens if you have a master key for the admin? Is it true immutability if the admin can still delete the data?
Mm, okay.
These kind of things. Also, in practicality, there's a date limitation. Like you could say the data is immutable for 10 years. Mm-hmm. But it has to be deleted eventually, especially for compliance. You know, you cannot store records of that infinitely. GDPR in Europe, same thing in California, it's coming everywhere. So there has to be a way to delete still, you know. So it's more complex than just immutability. It's policies, is who can delete and when, mm-hmm. Who has access and when, strict access control, logging, detecting what something happened. Because it's okay, all fine to have immutability, but if you don't know if something has changed in the background, then you don't have really immutability. You need a guarantee, right?
Got it. And I am assuming that your product as well has some type of immutability built into it. You mind talking about that?
Yeah. So we implement the S3 protocol for our object store, and there's a feature called object lock. Hmm. Which you have to set it up at the bucket level. And when you have object lock enabled, you have a policy that says, oh, the data cannot be overwritten, cannot be deleted until these conditions. And the conditions are typically time-based or somebody with a different access control that could override the policy.
And are there also different factors that need to be considered when you're talking of recovering from immutable storage, Giorgio?
Yeah. So it's all about integrity of the data, you know, and the speed of recovery. It's all, when you do backups of virtual machines, you don't talk about bytes. You talk about how many virtual machines you can recover per second, and the per second, you know, or per hour will be the biggest granularity. And you need to go as fast as possible while making sure you can detect that the data is still what it should have been. So it's not just about trust your immutability, also verify that it's actually what it should have been, especially in light of ransomware attacks. And you also want to be able to access specific versions. You know, since you cannot change data, you're actually going to write new versions each time you do a change. And you want to also be able to know exactly which version you want to restore, right? These are key factors. Also, sometimes you have more than one copy, especially remotely on another site. Sometimes you want to make sure both sites have the exact same data and make sure nobody has been tampered with. So it's part of some of the factor you consider when you recover.
Okay. And you mentioned a few different types of regulations. You mentioned SEC 17-A. I think that's part of Sarbanes-Oxley, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, correct.
And storing data on unalterable worm media, and it's making sure that you can't change it and modify it. What other types of regulations that...
So off-site backups, off-site copies are part of a regulation. Sometimes you are forced to make a copy and you are forced that the copy are up to date. No, you cannot always do it real time, but you have to be under a specific window. So maybe 1 hour, 1 day. No, that's things that we can guarantee in our software with asynchronous copies. And you stop accepting new data if the other site is lagging, because you want both sites to be within a certain time window. That also means you can stand up a new system on the other site. So there's a lot of testing has to be done. That is the standby on the other site actually ready to take over in case of a disaster?
Right.
These kind of things. There's also the encryption aspect and who holds the keys. You want to encrypt the data as well. Who actually holds the key and has that been compromised? You know, it's all of these things you have to think about. So as a storage system, as an object, we integrate with external key management services and we don't store any keys. So if you were to hack our system, you will never be able to decode the data because the keys are in an external system and we don't store them. You know? Then it's all about also doing a lot of testing. You cannot trust your recovery plans. You have to actually test recovery. That's expensive to do, but then you discover where the real issues are. Right?
Yeah, I agree. And there are, I've heard different conversations around disaster recovery and cyber recovery are two different things, because the cyber recovery aspect of it means that if a ransomware attack or some type of exfiltration event, bad actor gets into your network, and they render your data unrecoverable or they encrypt that data, then there's a difference between declaring a disaster and having to involve the SEC and your legal teams and cyber insurance and all of those different things. But what do you think are, from a ransomware perspective, different methodologies of protecting data from a storage system perspective?
So one of the most advanced that you can do is do remote copies on a different system. So let's say you have a NAS on-prem, that's your main system, and you want to backup. It makes sense to backup to an object store on a different site, because now you have two different systems with two different access management, two different data centers, two different technologies. So the chance of hacking both of them becomes minimal, right? There's also, as you restore, you need to have a source of truth of what the data should be. An object store is part of a versioning, part of a checksum that you get, because the metadata system in object store is different than the data storage system. So you can separate them. And so keep in your metadata engine some critical checksums of the data, so you know that what you restore is actually what you should restore. Because I've seen customers do a successful recovery of their data, but the data was garbage.
Yeah.
So all the process to read it worked just fine, but the data wasn't what it was supposed to be. So you cannot trust anything. So backup offsite to a different system, like an object store, and the object store will also guarantee that what you read is what it should have been.
So you're saying important backup to an object store. And yeah, I know that there's different levels of storage. So you have object storage and you'd have block level storage.
Yeah.
And maybe I need a refresher on how your whole scalability, your ring system works. And I'm sure that provides more availability capabilities as well.
Yeah. But it used to be that you would look at it into performance and think like high performance is block and object is a lower performance. Mm. That's not the case anymore. You can have a tier 0 object storage system. The difference is how you access the data, you know, on an object store, you're going to access it via a path, you know, the path will never change.
Mm-hmm.
And you take full files, you know, you would, in a block device, you're doing IOs on small blocks, you know,
mm-hmm.
you don't even have a notion of file. And then it's up to the file system that you deploy somewhere to make sense of the data. In an object store, you actually manipulate the files themselves, you know, with trees or paths and actual files. That gives you more granularity. That gives you better granularity in terms of what the user thinks. You know, if they mm-hmm. don't think about blocks, we think about video files, we think about backup files, right?
Right.
Then you can give access control that really match what the application means, you know. So like mm-hmm. this is read-only. This is something that changes a lot on the same system. Where on a block, what you see is just a soup of bytes, if you will, mm-hmm. you know, a flow, yeah. A big stream of bytes. And it's less granular. Either the block device is read-only or it is read-write, but you cannot go at the file user department.
And let's talk future really quick. Everyone's talking about artificial intelligence. Where do you see AI assisting just on the whole storage and backup and recovery landscape?
Yeah. If you think of AI as a incredible large statistical system,
mm-hmm.
You can use it to detect anomalies much faster than if you had heuristics or just a regular method. So typically in a healthy system, you should see a lot of writes to the backup,
mm-hmm.
some reads, but you don't restore your entire platform every day. So it's write intensive, more than read intensive. If a ransomware attack comes in, I bet you that you're going to see a lot more read operation than you should. Because the ransomware will try to read data, to mm-hmm. modify it, encrypt it with their own keys and store it back so that you cannot access your own data.
Okay.
So you can detect these patterns of IO that are not regular patterns, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's where AI can come in and check that. It's also things that our system always checks for consistencies of the data and its replicas. So if you make, mm-hmm. if you do a regression coding and you have some parities, make sure that the parities are still work and you can still recover your data if you lose a drive or something. This can be optimized with AI because instead of having to check the entire platform, you could check a subset of the data that is good enough to give you confidence over the entire data set. So there's some research on that we're doing. Can we use AI to make our detection and background task smarter? That makes sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And you mentioned encryption earlier, and I know that's really important to try to keep your data out of the hands of the bad guys to encrypt the data in flight and the data at rest as well. And just wanted to get your perspective on where we're headed from a futuristic perspective. Is encryption going to stay around, or is that maybe going to evolve and turn into something more advanced?
Well, I will answer in two ways. So encryption will obviously, for me, stay around. I don't see mm-hmm. that disappearing. Now what's going to be different is how do you protect against modern computers which are able to crack existing encryption? Like if you talk about Quantum, for example, you're going to need some different level of encryptions. What's very important is who manages the keys, right? That's one of the biggest problems you can have. And you see that data is encrypted at different levels. In flight, as you talked about, sometimes mm-hmm. the application encrypts it. But doesn't mean you don't want to encrypt at the storage level as well. So you actually multiple stages of encryption are happening in the data path. Now, one of the questions is, can you also make it impossible to reconstruct the data if you don't have all the pieces? And so we're looking at things like if you use more than one backend store, could be the cloud, could be on-prem,
mm-hmm.
and you actually only store pieces of your data into each of the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if one cloud gets hacked, they don't have enough to reconstruct your data. So these are other ways to protect, making sure that not a single data center has enough to actually steal your data.
Okay. Yeah, I love that. So maybe having it in different clouds or different regions or both.
I would say different clouds. And if you want to be very strict, different technology. Yeah. And like Azure and Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
No, okay. Sorry, it's the same. Azure and Amazon would be one way.
And I have a lot of college-age computer science students listening to Data Protection Gumbo. Can you give them some advice? Let's say there is a senior that's out there and he or she is about to graduate and they are looking for a specific aspect of information technology or a discipline to go into. Can you give them some advice or recommendation on where you see the industry headed just from an overall perspective on maybe giving them some knowledge, pointing them in the right direction?
Oh, so I'm going to be a little bit old school. So I've been mentoring students, mm-hmm. teaching a little bit also. Mm-hmm. And I would say that the basics are so important because people okay. jump on the latest fad. And mm-hmm. the basics are very important. So
distributed what kind of
system,
basics?
So distributed system science, okay. that's key. Everything is distributed today, you know. Kubernetes, it starts with a database of configuration that's distributed over three nodes. You know? Mm-hmm. And this has some implication in terms of availability, partition tolerance, performance. And so you have to learn the basics. Also in terms of language, there's always language wars. You know, is Go better than Rust? Is Rust better than C++? Okay, do some C, you know, and get to understand what's happening close to the hardware, because that's going to help you later on. When you're going to do your, I love JavaScript, but when you're going to manipulate with one line, you're mm-hmm. going to take a million CPU cycles. It's good to actually know the low level as well. So I would say really look at not just the latest thing, but look at the basics.
And so are you saying that they need to have some level of programming yes. experience?
Yes. Even a system designer needs some level, in my opinion, of programming experience, which is not scripting. You know, if you only do high level languages, which are great, they save my time. You know, I can span an AI system mm-hmm. in three lines of code with Hugging Face. That's great. But also, go see under the hood what's happening.
Okay, nice. And one thing that popped in my mind was, if you're going to do the basics as well, and this is one thing that I did not do, and that's learning networking really well. So yes. like the OSI model of... Mm-hmm. packets and presentation layer, all of that good stuff.
I mean, absolutely right. Yeah, especially with NVMe over Fabric and this kind of new tech, you see people talk about things they really don't understand. So if you do TCP, you know that you can have a server on the other side of a planet and still address it.
Yeah.
If you do NVMe over Fabric, no way, because you're constrained to a small in the scale of scality. You know, we deploy thousands of servers, but you're constrained to a small networking layout, right? Where you can have 200, maybe more servers talking together over NVMe over Fabric. You're certainly not going to have 10,000 servers in the same NVMe over Fabric network, right? Okay. And a lot of people don't know, they haven't looked into what you call the OC layer and these kind of implications. Now there's NVMe over TCP, which I think helps in that aspect, but you'd be surprised how many professionals don't understand what's happening under the hood.
Yeah, it's still a challenge today, and artificial intelligence is making it worse because people now feel that they don't have to go to the basics and learn some of the simple things because they can just ask AI to do it for them. So,
we were talking to a large prospect who wants to deploy 10,000 Scality nodes on all flash.
Mm, okay,
we love all flash. I think it's something that really can benefit our software, but when you do the diagrams and you see 10,000 servers and you're happy, well, somebody's going to have to implement it on the network and they're not going to be happy.
Wow, yeah.
Because that's a puzzle, you know, that's a Tetris of the highest order to be able to make all these servers talk to each other. Right. And now you go into failure domain because it's good, but in practice, in theory, you can build such a large system, but do you want it in practice? Right?
Yeah.
Do you want to have to manage upgrade on a 10,000 node cluster? Or do you want to subdivide into smaller clusters and find a way to route the traffic to the right destination? So this kind of looks simple on paper. It's impossible in real life is what we see every day.
Yeah, got it. Well, we're almost out of time here. And I do appreciate you taking some time out to speak with us here on Data Protection Gumbo. Any final thoughts or shout out information that you would like to provide for the audience before we close out here?
I'm very happy to be on the show. Thank you for having me. I hope it was useful to the listeners. And I guess next time we can talk about AI. That'd be interesting to talk about AI in the sense of an object store.
Definitely. We could definitely dive into AI because everyone else is talking about it. So we might as well go ahead and dive in and talk about it as well. So Giorgio, thank you so much for being a guest here, and want to let everyone know about the Backup and Recovery Professionals LinkedIn group that I run. There are 26,000 professionals in that group. So just go to LinkedIn and type in Backup and Recovery Professionals. We'd love to have you a part of the group as well. So Giorgio, thank you so much for being a guest. You.